This episode is an exclusive insight into the views of the LGIM investment team on what's happening in markets and what this means for investors. This podcast is intended for investment professionals. If you're enjoying LGIM Talks, why not subscribe in your Apple Podcast or Spotify app to make sure you never miss an episode.
Hello and welcome to this CIO market update from LGIM, which comes hot on the heels of the publication of our 2021 Outlook, the subject of today's call. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, Will Riley, Head of Solutions, and Emil van den Heiligenberg, Head of Asset Allocation. As usual, our podcast listeners can find a link to the presentation in this episode's show notes. Now, there's a huge amount to discuss today, so with no further ado, Sonia, good morning, and could you please walk us through the latest virus developments, the health of the global economy, and the state of financial markets?
Good morning, Max. Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. I hope, as always, that you're joining us well and safe. Yes, a lot to discuss. It's the 10th of December, and I think most of us probably are looking forward to see 2020 coming to an end. Quite a year it has been, and yet we've had more news, more updates, I think, than ever before over the past couple of weeks, actually. So I will just try and set the scene, but most importantly, obviously, today we would like to take a look forward and think about what 2021 might look like. You're fully aware that obviously the past couple of weeks, and November in particular, ever since the US election, markets have been in a really positive mood and risk assets had a very, very good run. This is obviously not just the US election and obviously the removal of that uncertainty, but mostly linked to the news we had around vaccine developments. And in the meantime, not only have we had three candidates, so three potential vaccines up for approval and distribution, but obviously here in the UK, we've had the first people actually being vaccinated. So a huge development, and as you have seen from the market reaction, that clearly paves the way towards normalization and hence the positivity. Now, what we would like to discuss today as well is that too much optimism too early? Is this warranted by what we're seeing in terms of the underlying developments? And so we will spend a few minutes on this. So in terms of the positive vaccine news, that clearly has removed the tail risks. What you see here is a snapshot on how countries are prepared and how they have pre-ordered vaccines literally per person. And you see very clearly that the developed world seems very well equipped to see people being vaccinated somewhere before the summer of next year. And that is a very positive development because, as we've discussed in the past, this is the necessary assumption to see the economy normalizing. Now, as we know, against this positive vaccine news, we have unfortunately seen cases and new infections rising again. We are in lockdown here in the UK. There's huge changes going on across Europe and the US in terms of what is necessary to keep new infections in check. And as you can see, we have been to some extent successful here in Europe, although the caseload still is far too high to see lockdowns being removed. Obviously, the Christmas, handling and the management of lockdowns throughout Christmas has been a very politically charged debate, and I think we're still waiting for some clarity around this. But this is the interesting kind of conflict we're seeing right now, that although the vaccine news are clearly very positive, it is too early to really see this through because we need the vaccine being fully, distributed and applied before we can really think about a full normalization in the economy. Now, moving forward, obviously, in terms of the positivity around potential economic normalization is further supported by the additional stimulus that we're not only expecting from the US but some other countries, and we've obviously talked about this a lot in the past. This is part of the positive economic picture for next year, so not only normalization but further fiscal stimulus that will help drive the economic recovery forward. With that in mind, we have updated our scenario analysis, and clearly we not only had to think about what a potential normalization could look like, but we likewise had to think about what the damage from current lockdown measures will be. And as you can see here, on a global basis, we still do not see the output gap being closed by the end of next year. As you can imagine, there's huge regional differences, so it's not that this is an evenly spread picture, and it's clear that the UK in particular is starting from a larger output gap, for example, compared to the US. So this is our current economic thinking, but it's clear that the question around economic scarring will be a very important one for next year. And we've highlighted that concept of economic scarring in the past. It is this understanding of the relocation effect that if we think about the negative impact that the pandemic had on specific sectors and industries, we have to assume that some of these changes will be permanent, and that particularly with regards to unemployment, that there will be permanent changes and that hence base unemployment might remain higher for longer. What we've done here is we've looked in greater detail what the kind of factors are that cause economic scarring, and it's clear that not only it is the labor market, which is mostly linked to the fourth point, the mismatch of skills, i.e. if you have permanent shifts, you might well see that some people might find they do not have the right skills to be easily re-employable in the market. But likewise, what we do know, obviously, it is a confidence question here. Consumer behavior has changed dramatically, and I think we all know it's quite normal as human beings. We're coming out of lockdown, and you know, our behaviors towards, you know, travel, hospitality, social aspects of life might change dramatically, and likewise unemployment and obviously the impact on the labor market will further dampen confidence. Last but not least, there will be an impact on, you know, the balance sheet of corporates, individuals, and credit channels, because obviously banks will have to make their assessment in the context of, you know, the suitability of specific companies, and as such, we do expect that lending conditions will tighten. So altogether, we will have to assess how bad or how large the impact of economic scarring will be, because that might well lengthen the recovery process and we might have to wait a bit longer before output gaps can finally be closed. We should not forget either, with the US election out of the way, geopolitical topics will re-emerge in 2021, and obviously there will be a huge focus on how the Biden administration will think about their China relations and how the relationship between those two countries will evolve throughout 2021. Now, I would like to finish off with a snapshot on markets. And it's clear we've had quite a roller coaster throughout 2021. And so we would like to show you a quarterly snapshot, because it's a very nice illustration of not only the massive drawdown in the first quarter, massive rebound in the second. The way markets traded on a very subdued note throughout the third quarter in anticipation of the US election, and obviously we should not forget throughout Q3, we did not have the positive vaccine news, which all appeared now in Q4, but now it is all about how quickly can the global economy normalize in 2021. What is the magnitude of economic scarring? How large will extra fiscal stimulus be? What is the role of central banks in this? And last but not least, and I think this is what Emil will now pick up, how can we, you know, think about all of this in the context of current valuation levels, and hence take a stance towards what is the most attractive asset class for 2021, and how should investors position? Max, back to you.
Well, thank you for that overview, Sonia. Those are very important questions. And yes, this is a great moment to turn to Emil. And Emil, I'll ask you, what does this backdrop mean for asset allocation in 2021? And can equities continue their stellar run?
Thanks, Max. 2021 will be a year of hope. As Sonia indicated, thanks to the vaccine, investors start to see the potential of the end of economic and social hardship. And more than that, the economic cycle has reset as well. We were late cycle in 2019, And we went all the way through a COVID-driven recession this year to be sort of early cycle at the moment. So the fundamental backdrop of hope and recovery should boost risk assets and, let's say, equity markets in particular. Equity valuations, in our view, are not troubling. At the moment are not too expensive. They may look expensive on an absolute basis, but on a relative basis, so if you look, for instance, at things like the equity risk premium, so that's the difference between the equity earnings yield and the bond yield, they remain very attractive. There is very little long-term return to be expected in bonds, which makes long-term expected equity returns really more attractive. And people actually will bid up equities to pay a premium for that additional return. All things considered, our base case is that equities will be the best performing asset class in 2021, and we would not be surprised if we see double-digit numbers in 2021 on top of what we've seen in sort of the year-end rally. There's one point of note. We're obviously not alone in this view. If you look at sentiment indicators, they have turned very, very bullish. We haven't seen this kind of bullish sentiment and optimism in the last 4 or 5 years. And things like the VIX index are dropping and dropping, which is an indication that investors are getting more and more comfortable with owning risk. Now, that sort of poses a dilemma for investors and also for us, because you have two powerful laws of investing opposing each other. On the one hand, the economic cycle is a very powerful driver for future returns. Early cycle, which we're in now, is the period when risk-adjusted returns of equities are historically been the strongest. On the other hand, there's a powerful principle that one should buy when others are fearful and sell when others are exuberant. So basically, should go against the sentiment, especially if the sentiment is stretched to one side. So my take in sort of the battle between these drivers is that in the end, the cycle is more important. So positive powers will win. I thought that was a nice Christmas thought as well.
That is indeed cause for hope. And I was going to ask you about the VIX, which has dropped quite a lot recently, the so-called equity market fear gauge. Do I take it from your comments then, Emil, that actually we should see that as a bullish signal or a bearish signal?
Well, on itself, I think optimistic sentiment is a bearish signal. On itself, it pays off in the long run to try to do the opposite of the prevailing sentiment, especially when sentiment indicators like the VIX are stretched. But with the economic backdrop where we are, I think that should prevail for longer-term investors. So we actually look at the sentiment indicators as more as timing instruments. So we want to take off some risk when there is too much optimism and put back on a bit more risk when sentiment normalizes. So at the moment, as I said, we are, in our view, in excessive optimism. So I wouldn't chase the rally. I would actually keep some firepower on the sidelines so you have a bit of optionality when there is when to add risk when there is a drawdown. A word on interest rate. We continue to believe in the lower for longer theme, so low interest rates. We see limited upside for bond yields at current level. Our research shows that inflation dynamics are way more important than growth dynamics in determining future interest rates. And that's even more true now, sort of the Fed have indicated that they will not react preemptively to any inflationary pressure. That should mean that sort of positive news on the vaccine for rollout, so a boost in growth, is unlikely to put enough upward pressure on inflation and therefore unlikely to put upward pressure on bond yield. As Sonja already indicated, there are still quite a lot of slack in the system, which will prevent inflation from materializing significantly in at least 2021, and we believe a bit longer than that as well. Credits, I think in our view, are less attractive than, for instance, equities. We've seen a massive spread compression since March, and starting spreads are a very good predictor of future returns. And so tight spreads in investment grade means there is a limited upside, and there are still downsides from downgrades and defaults. And to finalize, we see spreads in high yields and EMD as more attractive than investment grade. Over to you, Max.
Well, thank you, Emil, for talking through those dynamics. And you mentioned low yields and market volatility. It's a great point to turn to you, Will, and ask what were the key differences between the challenges faced by defined benefit pension schemes this year and during the last global financial crisis?
Thanks, Max, and good morning, everyone. I think there were interesting similarities and differences. Similar to the GFC, as Sonia highlighted earlier in March, we saw equity prices and bond yields fall together and credit spreads widened, which ended up being the perfect storm for pension funds as funding ratios took a massive tumble. Liquidity similarly became very challenged, and so assets that would normally be liquid struggled in terms of time to market and cost. In both environments, it was important to have flexibility across your portfolio in these situations to help with any types of cash flows, whether they be predictable, such as liability payments, or unpredictable, such as portfolio rebalancings, collateral, or even bulk transfers. To answer your question more directly, Max, in terms of differences, I think one of the key differences is around the market response, as Sonia highlighted earlier, and also by having a better capitalized financial system, especially the banks, who were much better prepared this time around. And whilst we did see repo and other sources of funding impacted, it was not nearly to the extent as it was in the GFC. We have seen some equities rebound, especially the US-led tech-heavy stocks, whereas government bond yields are still below 1% across the curve, and credit spreads, as Emil's just shown, are not much higher than this time last year. And so pension funds, trying to grapple with deficits and the need for cash flow, it has been clear that traditional financial markets do not necessarily offer the same valuation opportunities as they did a decade ago. In this environment, I think it is beneficial for pension schemes to be trying to utilize their longer-term investment horizons and try and capture some illiquidity and complexity premium that other investors may struggle to access. That being said, schemes have also arguably been more cash flow negative this time around. And so it was also very important to avoid being a forced seller of assets. I mentioned earlier about the predictable and unpredictable cash flows. And so it was key that schemes were fully aware of their cash flow requirements and had the means to be able to access liquidity in the cheapest way possible should events like this occur. As more schemes have become naturally cash flow negative, this has highlighted the importance of ensuring not only the assets are generating the right amount of cash flows required to meet your payments or your outflows, but also the right type. A good example of this was, our buy and maintain assets, which were, they were focused on high quality, low leverage, and sustainable companies, and this would have helped weather the volatility storm that occurred in March as uncertainty increased. More recently, we've also seen the challenges introduced into the portfolio mix through the RPI-CPI announcement, and this highlights the importance of locking down mismatches between assets and liabilities. Especially for schemes with CPI liabilities, using that 1% wedge assumption will push up the value of liabilities. And so schemes will have to look to investment returns to make this back up. Given these increased cash flow challenges, we are seeing increased appetite for cash flow-driven or CDI-type style strategies. And also given our annuity book and being part of an insurance company, we're also seeing more appetite for pension funds to want to invest more like an insurance company as they think more about their endgame opportunities. This has meant working with our clients on broader mandate opportunities in LDI and buy and maintain, as well as in secure income asset portfolios.
Right. Would it be fair to say then, Will, that these are some new tools available to schemes with which to tackle the challenges you've just outlined that weren't necessarily available over a decade ago?
Definitely, Max. I think the market, and especially from an asset manager's perspective, we have seen asset managers and clients, want to be able to give people more discretion in thinking about how to handle the various aspects of liquidity across across the portfolio. And especially when it comes to, CDI strategies, where you do have the ability to try and see how you can access the cheapest forms of liquidity. These are new tools that, pension fund manager, investment managers like ourselves do then have the ability to access and try and make considerable savings for the clients when you do have those, those unpredictable cash flows that hit your scheme.
Right. Well, let's look at one of the many assets now that have seen remarkable price moves this year, and that's gold. Emil, how do you deploy gold within multi-asset portfolios, and what's the outlook for the yellow metal next year?
Indeed, gold had a fantastic year this year. Peak performance of plus 40% and still has a year-to-date 25% performance. So outperforming actually most of the developed equity markets except, for instance, tech stocks. And, gold bugs, and often my team accuses me of being one, which I'm not, tell us that sort of it's an asset class for all seasons. Likely to do well in a reflationary market like we are in now, likely to do well in a flight to quality, so during a time of crisis and stress. The last feature, sort of like doing well when equity markets and where risk sells off and spreads widen, would obviously be a fantastic feature to hold gold on a strategic basis. However, is this true or is it still true? Does gold provide that protection? And our research shows that it depends, and certainly not in all cases, gold prices are doing well in sort of equity sell-offs. In the last 5 years, we've seen six risk-off periods, and only in half of them gold has done well. So what do we learn from this? We think it's dangerous to think about gold as a buy-and-hold asset, which then hedges in times of weakness. If you hold gold as a hedge, you need to be manage it actively, and usually gold needs the profit on gold needs to be monetized early in the sell-off to be profitable, as later on gold seems to correct with risk assets as well. So we've invested in gold a couple of times this year, so benefited from the strong rally. But always look to take profit after a period of price appreciation. We continue to consider gold on a tactical to medium-term basis rather than on a strategic basis. And then on outlook, I think at the moment gold will struggle a bit because there is so much optimism, because everyone's focusing on equities at the moment. You get that there's less attention for that diversifying asset. Longer run, we still think real yields could actually go down if inflation pressures creeps up a bit and the dollar could weaken, which are positive features for gold. So I would still expect gold to do actually a positive return next year as well. Max, if I may...
Yes, please.
Can I do Bitcoin quick as well? Because we have lots of questions on Bitcoin.
Please do.
Yeah? There's lots to like in a way of Bitcoin, especially if you're a punter and a speculator. Stellar return, massive volatility, and supply is limited. And why is that important? Because if you're afraid of monetary financing, central banks creeping up the printing press, then at some point that would lead to runaway inflation. And Bitcoin with no absolute limited supply, think that is a reason for them to invest in it. However, there's lots of things in my view, in our view, which makes Bitcoins actually not an investment, but more a speculation. There's no intrinsic value. It's not regulated or recognized. It takes a lot of inner energy to produce, so it's very ESG unfriendly, I would say. And it's very expensive and slow to use in day-to-day transactions. But what does that mean? I'm convinced that at some point there will be a better alternative for a digital currency in the market. And at that point, Bitcoins will be worthless. Right. So, and it's very likely central banks will develop their own electronic currencies, which then will be way better supported, way much easier to use. So it's a speculative asset, not an investment asset. It could easily double next year. So I don't have a view that much on Bitcoins. And so it's a fact. It's interesting for punters, and by the way, for criminals as well. But at the end of the day, we all know how this ends. And in my view, Bitcoins are the tulips of the 21st century.
Let's move on now to a very different sort of asset to Bitcoin. Will, what role do you see secure income assets, such as private credit, playing in meeting the challenges that you described earlier?
Yeah, thanks, Max. As mentioned earlier, pension schemes that are trying to grapple with deficits and also this need for cash flow, when you have sort of financial markets as we're seeing now, where some of the valuation opportunities are maybe not as, you know, what they were a decade ago, pension schemes should be looking to try and think about, you know, utilizing that long-term investment horizon and try and capture the, you know, some of the liquidity and the complexity premium that other investors will struggle to access. Also, you know, secure income is a good way for pension funds to be able to access more diverse cash flow through the liquidity premium. It does mean that the schemes need to have an accurate understanding of their overall cash flows, and especially around their ability to quickly access liquidity. As a large secure income allocation, will limit their ability to cater for well as unpredictable events. And having the right type of cash flow driven investment or CDI strategy that is capturing those illiquidity elements of the secure income asset class, and allowing you to allocate the liquidity premium in a considered and risk controlled manner, will allow the pension fund to better manage liquidity as well as provide more cash flow during those challenged times. Having a single mandate that has that ability to asset allocate between, for example, the public credit, in a buy and maintain sense, and then also they have to access sort of cheaper forms of liquidity, you know, potentially through, you know, repo or through the LDI portfolio, and even think about using leverage. It does allow for a much more efficient allocation across your matching portfolio. And lastly, some investors have talked about the benefits that liquid assets can bring, in not having their pricing being updated as frequently as public ones, and allowing for less volatility on the funding ratio. And arguably, this is more in line with a longer term risk taking strategy, and can be beneficial for the pension scheme.
Very interesting. Well, thanks for that, Will. Sonia, we would be remiss if we didn't mention Brexit, especially after last night's dinner of destiny in Brussels, with the transition period due to end shortly. Is there an end in sight, or do you think we'll still be talking about the process when we discuss the outlook for 2022? And is there anything else that you'd like to add this morning before we wrap up?
Yeah, I guess it was the inevitable that we have to mention Brexit, although it's fair, particularly given that you mentioned the dinner, we still don't have more clarity, and it might well go either way. And although I would very much hope that we will not have the same debate at the end of 2022, it might well be that the longer-term implications will take some time to materialize. But I wanted to finish actually on a slightly different note, because although this might not be clear yet how you know, Brexit will turn out. I think with everything that Emil has said, it's clear that there has been, a real change in the way how we look at markets. And, you know, we have talked about long-term structural themes a number of times, but it's very clear that most of these have seen a huge level of acceleration throughout 2020. And we believe if you think about the backdrop we've outlined and the positivity towards risk assets under the assumption of economic normalization and continued fiscal and monetary support, we believe it's very important for investors to understand what the long-term structural drivers are. You know, technology clearly has been a topic for years, but likewise has seen again another level of acceleration in 2020, and it's not surprisingly hence that the Nasdaq is up 37% year to date. But energy, another one, climate change has seen a huge acceleration, and we believe that there will be further structural shifts and create investment opportunity. So understanding where the relative winners are from the structural changes, where our behavioral changes will be here to stay, I think is something we focus on a lot. And although these are four broad topics, we believe there are sub-themes emerging that really provide great investment opportunities. And we will continue to focus to make sure we have a good understanding on what these drivers are, because most of these will provide investment opportunities with structural growth features that are well beyond and better what average GDP growth will deliver. So, you know, picking actively, so understanding the overall risk backdrop, but then really understanding where structural drivers will create, you know, pockets of investment opportunity, we believe is the right attempt to manage and navigate 2021.
Well, that's a great point on which to end this week's call. Thank you, Sonia, Will and Emil, for your time today. I'd like to thank you, our clients, for logging in. You can find the full outlook on our website. And all I'd add is, from all of us at LGIM, we wish you a happy and healthy holiday and new year.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.